Hello, and what is up, everybody? It is the Wind Up Podcast. I am your host, Mike of MTGA Wines, and we're getting into the direct-to-consumer conundrum today. It's perfect timing. There's all kinds of news that has come out, reports that have come out over the last week or so regarding everything from the wine business, how tasting rooms are doing around the country, what companies are doing to adjust to this current crazy market that we're experiencing in the world of wine. And we're going to dive into all of that here. As usual, a couple of very quick announcements. Be sure to follow us on all of our social networks at MTGA Wines, YouTube, The Book of Face, Instagram, the social network formerly known as Twitter. Be sure to like, subscribe, rate, and review the show here. That way you can help us get it out into the world. Share it with your wine-loving friends, all of that good stuff. Be sure to head to mtgawines.com and blairpaytonwines.com to check out what we're all about. Check out our wine club. Sign up for our mailing list. Be sure to be 21 years of age or older when you do that. And for those of you that want to submit questions to our monthly Q&A session at the end of each month, you can do so by going to mtgawines.com. Just scroll down to the bottom of the homepage there. There's a little email box form for you there. You can also slide into our DMs on any of those social networks I mentioned previously. Let's get into it. I'm trying to do the rapid fire announcements moving forward. I'd like to do this in a hot minute and like keep it moving. So this is the episode. It's a Wednesday morning as I'm recording this. Beautiful day out here. We're getting a nice little heat wave over the next couple of days before it cools back down. We got a nice hot cup of coffee. We are kind of in a little bit of our summer lull, June gloom, if you will, which is why it's great to see kind of this direct-to-consumer news coming out and about from a few different sources. It's really good to see. Now, to give you all a little bit of background, direct-to-consumer is what we call selling directly to you guys, the consumers. You're not buying it through a retail shop. You're not buying wine through a restaurant, right? It is going from the winery directly to you. This is something that was made legal, I think, back in 2005 or so, officially. There was a court ruling that allowed us to ship directly to other states when it comes to wine as a beverage. It's only been like 20 years since we've technically, like legally been able to do that, even though, of course, there are probably ways that it was done previously, because let's face it, this country's not above a little bit of bootlegging. Am I right? So it's a fairly new phenomenon. Wine clubs are fairly a new phenomenon. These are all things that, realistically, in the world of wine, have not been around all that long. And as a result, I'm still very much of the opinion that it is in its infancy. And while we have found ways to utilize them to kind of our advantage as businesses, and hopefully for you guys to be able to acquire the wines that you want, that you can't necessarily get out and about around the country, there's still, you know, a lot to be learned here. You know, over the last, you know, year, we've talked about kind of the downturn of the wine industry and how things have been tough. And you're seeing some of those results kind of pan out here. There's more and more people talking about how they kind of feel as though we've kind of hit the bottom of this downward trend, and that we're going to start seeing a little bit more of an uptick moving forward. And we're going to get into kind of like why that might be today, why I am cautiously optimistic about the outlook for the rest of the year, but realistically, kind of how this is going to affect you guys, and kind of how this affects you guys when you decide to go wine tasting in and around your own neck of the woods, whether you're coming out here to Napa, Sonoma, whatever the case may be. So we're going to try and cover all of that. Now, there are going to be a couple of links in the description of the podcast here. So if you want some more information on this, a couple of the articles that I'm going to be referencing, please feel free. The first one we're going to dive into is the Silicon Valley Bank. Yes, they still exist after a tumultuous time period. What was it, last year or the year before? And for those that don't know, SVB has historically been like the bank in the wine industry. They have a full-on like wine department that was established specifically kind of for our industry, because it's such a unique industry. It's very different than many others. We work in kind of with and around a lot of different, challenges and issues that maybe other businesses don't, given the farming and agricultural aspect of it, but also the, you know, aging and time frame of everything that has to happen. I mean, there's just a lot that goes into wine that is very different than many other consumer goods. You're not necessarily going to see kind of this immediate return and something that's quick to market, you know, in like a couple of months or weeks. It's going to take years in some cases. And on top of that, you have this agricultural piece that is can be incredibly tumultuous and difficult to work with, around, and through at times. So they've done a great job over the years, as far as I've been concerned. I've only had good experiences with the folks that I've known there. I've had some friends that have worked for SVB in the past that, you know, at the time, probably before their little bit of a tumultuous period where they were over-leveraged in a certain way, that it was all good. And very specifically, Rob McMillan out there, he puts together this direct-to-consumer report every year. And it goes through just a little bit of like everything between visitation to certain regions, how much tastings are, what's happening in terms of discounting and wine clubs, nutrition and growth. And it really can give you a good pulse on, of course, what has happened kind of in the last, you know, 5 or so years within the wine industry. And I wanted to center on, because this is a conversation that has continued to pop up amongst colleagues and friends of ours. It's something that you all have continued to bring up in comments and thoughts and questions and things around visiting wineries and things of that nature. And that's kind of like the experience and the tasting fees and, you know, how that's kind of impacting the business. So if you guys are diving into that, it's a 70-page document. It's a 70-page report that Silicon Valley Bank puts out. So it's a hefty read. It's pretty quick and concise. I think there's a lot of good information in here. I do believe, though, that if you're in the wine industry and this report is particularly like enlightening, you're probably like way behind the eight ball. Like, this is all stuff that you, if you're paying attention, you should probably already know some of this kind of anecdotally. And we do talk a lot about just kind of personal experience on the show, kind of what the vibe is in the industry. But this actually puts some real like numbers behind it, which is good to see and kind of have that backbone of like, okay, it's not just me being crazy. Like, this is actually stuff that's happening. So let me adjust my camera here real quick. Like, boop, 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 boop. Here we go, because it's just a PDF. Oh, I didn't really do that well. Oh, God, technical difficulties. There we go. Okay. So here we got a couple of graphs, and this is specifically tasting fees. Here we go. Let's see if I can zoom in on this just a touch. Boom. There we go. So here we go. And the first line up here, we'll kind of dive into this, is that how does a winery owner determine how much to charge for a tasting? To a large extent, they take note of what their neighbors are charging, as well as their own cost of providing tastings and experiences. Originally intended to offset the cost of wine pour, tasting fees today have evolved due to frothy consumer market and the addition of more diverse and extravagant experiences. Tasting fees are now an essential part of the small premium winery's revenue model. So I mentioned we're going to kind of dive right into the tasting fee side of things. And this is exactly what we've been talking about. And a couple weeks ago, when we talked about Lawrence Family Estates and you know, the fact that their tasting fee at Heights doesn't even cover the cost of like what the experience is for them. This is what we're talking about, is that this started about 10 years ago or so, where kind of this millennial generation that I get to be a part of started to look for not just coming out and trying some wine and buying it and moving on, but we enjoyed the experiences. And I think many of you out there as well, you kind of enjoy the experiential nature of, you know, visiting a winery. You know, it became more of a tourist attraction in general, which hence why people were just trying to cover the cost of like wine poured and staffing. It was very kind of bare bones of like, let's try some wine and we'll move you on to the next place. And that's evolved immensely to just revenue streams, right? Let's use our own tasting fee kind of as an example here, because we charge typically $75 per person for a tasting, which is not cheap, although it can be waived by joining the wine club, purchasing X amount of wine, so on and so forth. So there are ways to avoid it, which many wineries do employ kind of sales tactics such as that. But I know for a fact that given a year, every year roughly, you know, it costs me about $60 to host a person. This is a number that I've shared regularly over the last couple of years. And, you know, we charge $75 because, hey, this could drive a little bit of revenue. And, you know, that would be great. You know, if we make a little bit of money, you know, it's probably not going to be a huge impact on our bottom line, but we don't want to be operating at a loss. So let's just say, for the sake of easy math, that we're, you know, our net profit on that is, you know, $15, right? Okay, $15. If you host 100 people and you charge 100 tastings, okay, cool. You can see my calculator just in case you can't do the math yourself. That's $1,500 in profit. Now, is that really going to move the needle for a tasting room? Probably not. But that does mean I can buy an extra barrel if I want, because my French oak barrels range from about like $1,300 to $1,600 per barrel. So I'm like, okay, well, that has a direct impact on kind of like money in the bank that I can use for capital investment and buying equipment and stuff like that. So you're like, okay, like if I'm actually making money on these tastings, you know, that's great. Now, keep in mind that I could show you the reports that for us, you know, we only charge people of the visitors that we see throughout a calendar year. I think for the last like 3 or 5 years, we've only charged at most like 36 tastings at most. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, it was 40 people that we are charge a tasting fee to. That means we're making $600 profit. $600. So, you know, that kind of model and what this kind of starts with in the tasting fee side of things, that tasting fees are now an essential part of small premium wineries' revenue models, yes and no. You know, it's not necessarily the case, because $600, even $1,500, that's a rounding error, right? Would I be pissed if I lost somewhere between $600 and $1,500? Like all of a sudden I just had a magical bill appear and I needed to pay it. Actually, that happened last week because I had to take my car into the shop. And of course, more needed to be done to it than I wanted to be done to it. But here we are. All of a sudden you got a bill you got to pay, right? And yeah, it'd be nice to have that money in the bank. But realistically, if our business sinks because we don't have somewhere between $600 and $1,500 in the bank, we've got bigger problems. Right? So for certain wineries, this isn't necessarily true. Again, it's so subjective. It depends on your model. It depends on your business. You know, like this is not necessarily going to be like a one size fits all kind of thing, but I wanted to provide you at least kind of an example, right? Outside of like the Lawrence family thing that we talked about, which is, you know, you can go back and listen to the episode. I think we titled it, you know, Why Your Wine Business is Losing Money. Not necessarily centered on them specifically, but you know, that's stuff like this that you just don't take into account, right? Okay. So, you know, the big question here, a couple paragraphs down, is will consumers be willing to pay such fees in the future? A few wineries have experimented with eliminating fees altogether, while some abhor the idea. While it's worthwhile to experiment and reevaluate after reviewing the data. It's easy to say that charging no fee would result in setting up the same bad behavior experience when tasting fees weren't charged, but what if the fee structure is tied to marketing to the critical 36 to 46-year-old age group? And this is where we get into demographics and trying to, you know, talk about like how we entice more people to get into wine, right? So let's scroll down here to the average tasting fee by region. And this probably shouldn't come as a surprise to too many of you. For those of you listening, the graph in front of us is basically, shows you Napa, Sonoma, Oregon, Santa Barbara, Paso, other areas in California, Washington, and others around the United States. Based on this, and I should mention this, there's one thing that I do kind of have like, I didn't see this in the report. I'm wondering if it's somewhere in the footnotes. I didn't catch it. But the one thing I don't like about this report is that there's not like a weighted average, it seems like. Maybe it is, but it doesn't state that it is. Because I would love to know like how many wineries from Oregon reported versus how many from Sonoma, Napa, the rest of the U.S. Like I would love to know kind of the mix and how many people are actually involved. Because this is all like self-reporting. This is just a survey that they send out. And I would love to know kind of just basic demographics of what wineries and from where, that doesn't appear to be in here somewhere. I might have missed it, so, you know, forgive me, SVB, if I missed something like that, but that'd be really cool to see, to kind of understand, like, the weight of this data. Now, back to the main point at hand, you'll notice here that Napa leads the pack, obviously. Tasting fees in Napa now average $80 for their standard tasting fee, and if you're paying for a reserve tasting, quote-unquote, that goes up to $143. The next closest, respectively, in each of these will be Sonoma at $55 for their standard tasting fee, $92 for the reserve tasting fee. Below that, you have the average, which is $42 around the country and $76 around the country, respectively, for your standard versus reserve tasting fee. So this kind of makes sense in that if you scroll back up to the tasting fees by a standard retail price, and that the more expensive the wines get, the higher the tasting fee. Now, that kind of like these two graphs obviously kind of go hand in hand. These are pages 44 and 45 in this report. If you wanted to scroll through kind of this tasting fee graph section, it actually starts back on page 38, I believe. You can also see like the annual change in average tasting fees, which has basically gone nowhere but up, except in 2023, you saw them start to decline ever so slightly. An interesting little trend that probably should have been the shot across the bow for people that, hey, some rough times might have been coming along. So, you know, this is the kind of stuff. Oh, and I'll actually one more point is, you know, in what circumstances do you waive tasting fees? That is also on here on the next page if you scroll down a little bit further. And of course, you have joining the wine club. An overwhelming, you know, a good majority of people will waive if people join the wine club. If you purchase a specific number of bottles or a dollar amount, tasting fees can also be waived. And there is a small percentage, about up to 14%, where folks will not waive a tasting fee, period, if wine is purchased or a wine club is joined or whatever the case is, which is kind of wild. So let's kind of table that for now and get into it. So we have all that in mind. That was kind of a whirlwind of data. And, you know, I think that there's a lot that we can kind of like garner from this. And this is going to roll right into kind of the next article that we're going to dive into here. Is, you know, we're going to focus a little bit on Napa here. I don't know kind of boots on the ground what's going on in Oregon and Paso Robles around the rest of the U.S. But, you know, we're obviously embedded here in the Napa area. This is obviously one of the most unique and amazing places to visit in the world of wine, of food, and all these things. It is very expensive to conduct business here. There are a lot of people that come here every year hoping that this might be the one time to really enjoy this place and they can soak it all in, or that maybe it becomes a more regular trip for them. And this tasting fee thing is always kind of this point of contention. And, you know, I hope that some of those, you know, when we talk about kind of the profitability and you know, a tasting as kind of a revenue generator, that is something that is very, very new because of this experiential nature of things that really started picking up ahead of steam, you know, what, 10, like I mentioned, 10, 12 years ago, whatever the case was. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that necessarily. But this goes back to kind of like the transparency conversation here, and even kind of the shipping conversation that I mentioned last week or the week before about, you know, why people charge tasting fees, why it's $30 here versus $90 here versus whatever. You know, it's easy to explain it when I can sit you down or we can sit you down and say like, hey, here's the deal. This is how things are. But for the overwhelming majority of places, you just don't know. You show up to a winery, you might know what the tasting fee is, maybe, but they don't necessarily tell you at the gate like, oh, this is how you can get it waived. Oh, this is what we do for shipping. Oh, this is kind of like how we as a business, like here's our SOP, standard operating procedures for those that want to keep up with the acronyms, of like how this works. And it kind of sucks sometimes because there's a good buddy of mine. We're chatting in a backyard watching the hockey game a few days ago. Unfortunately, Canada is going to go another year without a cup. Although we have some new friends that work for the Florida Panthers. So, you know, that's fun. So we were talking about this in terms of like that small percentage of folks that don't waive tastings for like anybody, for any reason. And he's a he owns his own tour company out here. Someone that I grew up, you know, around out here. And we were just talking about, like, I was saying, like, I don't get it. Like, from a business standpoint, like, I know you want to sell wine. I know you're spending money opening expensive wine. And kind of as we saw on those charts, like, the more expensive the wine gets, the more expensive the tasting fee gets. Fine, whatever. You're trying to cover your cost. It might be a revenue generator, you know, as we talked about. But if you're charging, you know, north of $100 for a tasting, even for your reserve tasting, $150, $200, $250, and he was talking about specifically a place that charged, I think it was $250 for a person to do a tasting. So you and like a couple, like two couples show up, you're at $1,000 the second you sit down, right? Also, the expectation is that you're going to buy at least a six pack of their wine, which I think started, I think he was talking about started at like $175 or something like that. So not only are you out the $1,000, but now each couple, theoretically, each couple needs to buy at least a six pack of wine, which amounts to a case. Because I suck at math, this is why I always have my phone right here, because I love to talk numbers. But let's say it was a $175 bottle of wine, and they're expecting you to buy each couple a six pack, that's $2,100, right? So you're out, just for this one winery visit, you're looking at spending north of $3,000 just for the experience and buying some wine. And that's the expectation, right? That, hey, this isn't really negotiable. If you're coming up here, this is what you're doing. And we're not necessarily going to waive this. Like this is, like, you should be honored. For me, this is not what they said, but this is kind of my opinion. It's like, oh, you should feel honored that you even have the ability to try this wine, right? Which is a kind of a joke, but, you know, to each their own, I guess. And I told him this. I was like, I just don't get it. Like, it's my job to, number one, there's another great colleague of ours that owns his own tour company. And he, every year, this is the conversation that happens kind of like behind, you know, the scenes when we're trying to work with referring people places. And it's like, hey, if you like this winery, then you should probably try this winery. If you, you know, we try and kind of guide people and provide these itineraries. And there is this like underculture within like the referral community, whether it's concierges, whether it's drivers, kind of these folks that put together itineraries, because we deal with this all the time. People will tell us like, hey, I want to bring more people out to try your wines, but I just don't know if they're going to buy anything. And I'm like, okay, like, that's not your job. Your job is to provide them with like a great itinerary, great experiences that you think they're going to enjoy. It's my job to sell wine. I have wine to sell. I'm not like, there are certain wines we sell out of, you know, but we have wine available. So don't worry about whether or not they're going to buy. That's my job. We don't require a purchase for you to come visit. You can get your tasting fee waived if you purchase a certain amount or join our wine club or whatever the case may be. So, you know, like, there's plenty of options. And we try and lay that out for people in a way so that hopefully we can entice people to come visit, try our wines, get to know Brittany or I, and, you know, find a new favorite wine out there. So there's this weird culture kind of behind the scenes of people visiting wineries where certain referral sources will be like, I want to bring you people, but I don't want to waste your time. And this is why I don't get the like required purchase kind of outrageous, like super high tasting fee thing, is that if you have wine to sell, especially right now in what is a rough time to be in the wine industry, and you have inventory that's stacking up because your burn rate's not nearly what you thought it would be with this downturn, if you're being snooty about it, you're not doing yourself any favors, right? And that's why, you know, I think historically, you know, for us as a business, we've tried to lean into, like, we're trying to make this as approachable as we can. Yes, there's going to be some sort of fee involved if you don't purchase any wine, but that's because we need to stay in business, you know? And yeah, that $600 or $1,500 might not make up that much of a difference, but if I can buy a new barrel, that's great. And like I mentioned, if I only am charging a few dozen people for tasting, that means the overwhelming majority of people that are coming out and visiting us are purchasing wine. And we're saying, hey, you guys are buying wine, you're good. We're not going to worry about charging you a tasting because you're supporting us as a business. And it's more important for us to sell wine than it is to charge you for a tasting. and we're not going to be a dick about it and tell you like, hey, you have to buy 6 bottles. I don't really care if you like it or not, but you're here. You need to buy 6. It boggles my mind, you know, that certain places will do this. Now, listen, exceptions, you know, to prove the rule, right? If you're truly like sold out of your wines, like everything's allocated and you have a small inventory of wine that you can share with people for tasting experiences, then yeah, you've got the market cornered. Fine, charge whatever you want. That's great. But you tell people ahead of time, like, hey, by the way, we want you to buy the wine. There's a wait list right now. The second, you know, a slot comes available, we'll be able to make it available to you. Like, there's a way to market it, right? So in that situation, it's like, okay, fine. Like, yeah, it's $250 a tasting, but you can't buy the wine anyway. You just have to join the mailing list. And, you know, there's a certain, like, fee to do this. In fact, that's kind of what my, you know, dad does with some of his Ghost Horse wines. And that, you know, yeah, it's an expensive tasting fee, but that's because there's not a lot of wine of that to sell. And there's not a lot of bottles of that to begin with. So if one's going to be opened or many are going to be opened for a tasting, it really has to make up for, you know, that cost. Or this is a big thing that some places don't really keep track of, is your loss of opportunity, right? Because let's use like our Cabernet Franc, for example. It's a wine that we sell out of. You know, every bottle of Cab Franc that I open is one more that I can't sell. So let's say I open up a couple cases of it, you know, that could be a couple $1,000s of revenue that I don't generate because we ended up pouring it for other folks, which is fine. Like, we want to share it with the world. We want it to be out there. We want people to try it. But it is, you know, it is affecting us from a sales perspective because we only make 300 bottles of it. If we open up 24 of them for tastings and events and all this other stuff, I mean, that's a solid percentage of inventory that we now cannot sell. You know what I mean? So you do have to account for kind of that loss of opportunity and loss of sales because you're not, you know, you're not able to sell that bottle of wine. Now, obviously, you know, from accounting perspective, you know, you mark that as like your product samples and like cost of doing business. But you also have to, you know, kind of earmark that potential loss in revenue because you don't have that wine to sell. So if that's your situation, if it's highly allocated and these are wines that you sell out of, then yeah, charge whatever the hell you want. But going back to the original point, like if you have wine to sell, you probably shouldn't be super radically exclusive about how you do business. Unless that's just your vibe and that's what you want to come off as, then all right, fine, whatever. I get it. Exclusivity does sell to a certain extent, even though the exclusivity model is dead. Any high-end wine that you have ever wanted to try or buy, you can buy online right now. It might be through a third party. You might not be getting it from the winery directly, but you can buy it. It's not hard. You can get any wine you want right now. So let's not pretend that exclusivity is like the reason, right? Let's not pretend that that's the reason. So it was great to have this conversation with a couple of buddies over the last week. And then sure enough, this brings us to article number 2. Oh my goodness. Mr. JCB is at it again. Let's go ahead and redo my camera again here for those of you that are watching. Boop, 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 boop. The good old winebusiness.com. Boisse. My alma mater, some of the first jobs I had when I got back into the industry here, Boisse announces complimentary tastings at Deloche Vineyards and Raymond Vineyards, declaring the wine world is open to all to learn, discover, and enjoy. This happened just a couple of days ago. Of course, the man with the plan, Mr. Jean-Charles Boisse. I don't know Claire Tooley, Master of Wine, who is working for them now. I have not met her in particular. Now, obviously, let's paint a little bit of perspective here. Boisse is not a small company. They're not. They make a bunch of wine and a bunch of other products as well. But I think this illustrates kind of the point of, you know, doing what you need to be doing, you know, kind of for your business and what you think is going to make the most sense. Now, having worked there, and I haven't worked for Boisset since 2014, so it's been more than a decade, all right? So I'm going to give you a little bit of kind of what our, what my experience was then. I'm also going to provide a little anecdote with another smaller family winery here as well. When you get to that size, we're talking hundreds of thousands, millions of cases of product potentially. I don't know how much wine they actually make these days, but you know, back then, Raymond Vineyards, I think, when I was there, was somewhere around 200,000 cases of wine. And then just that brand, and then had a couple other brands that would, you know, kind of bolster that. And then Deloche wasn't huge, I don't think, but they still made a lot. I actually don't remember what their production level ever was. But, you know, when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of cases, let's say, potentially millions, right? The direct-to-consumer side of things plays less of a role. Your main cash cow is the three-tier system. It's distribution. It's exporting stuff. You're selling it in retail shops, restaurants around the country, around the world. That accounts for the overwhelming volume of sales. Now, the margins aren't as good, but we've talked a lot about that on this show, that even if you're making a dollar per bottle, but you sell a million bottles, a dollar profit, net profit is not so bad, right? And I guarantee you the margin's probably better than that for some of these companies. Maybe Boisset, maybe not, but let's keep that kind of perspective, right? The direct-to-consumer side of things is really there to enhance the overall experience and connection to the brand. Also, if you can sell some wine at that retail price in your tasting room or through your wine club, it does support that business in a bigger way. We've talked about that a lot on the show as well, how wine clubs are the lifeblood of small brands, but hugely beneficial to large brands as well. You can go back and listen to our Wine Club Lifeblood episode, I think from a year or two ago, if you want to know more about how important, especially to small producers, the wine club is. So let's give you another example. Speaking of which, there's another family brand here just kind of northwest of St. Helena that's, I think, somewhere in like the 8,000 case range, like give or take, like very, very small in the grand scheme of things. Certainly a lot smaller than a Boisset Family Estates. They do charge for their tastings. They have a very robust wine club. And they sell a good chunk of their wine through wholesale as well. They're, from what I remember this gentleman saying, they're about like 50-50. That about half their wine goes through, you know, the wholesale side of things, and then the other half goes through the direct-to-consumer, wine club tastings, so on and so forth. And, you know, they might sell a bunch of wine, a bunch of volume through that, you know, wholesale side of things. But even though the direct-to-consumer portion of their business is about 50% of their sales volume, it accounts for like 90% of their revenue. Like that's the difference it can make, right? When it comes to doing tastings, being a part of wine club allocation lists, so on and so forth. Even if the wines are pretty well distributed around the country, even for a smaller brand, you know, they might be very well known, they might have be very prestigious, and they might be, you know, very well sought after around the country, but the direct to consumer side of things just overwhelmingly positive for us small guys. That's just how it is, right? And here's the great thing about that small family brand, and even for Boisset for that matter, is that they recognize where their bread is buttered. They recognize the benefit of creating great consumer interactions and experiences, whether that is offering a free tasting of some sort in the case of Boisset Family Estates, or just being able to connect with that small family brand that's been doing it for like 40, 50 years out here, right? That's the kind of stuff that I think the wine industry needs to get back to, right? Realistically, I mean, because even at post-COVID, Domaine Chandon did this, because they would see 1,000 people on a Saturday. You can imagine the revenue that you're generating if you're, you know, again, seeing 1,000 people, you know, on a Saturday. And obviously, Domaine Chandon is a part of Moët Chandon, LVMH. Like, they are an enormous company, right? That's Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy, for those that aren't aware. Again, trying to keep up with the acronyms. Like they that's an outrageously huge company. Are the tasting fees at Domaine Chandon really going to move the needle? Maybe, depending on what they're making off of them when they were seeing 1,000 people on a Saturday. But post-COVID, they realized, and this is something that's great about the SVB report as well, is that you see the statistics of like what happens when you do more personalized, sit-down, dialed-in experiences, like we were talking about, versus bellying up to the bar and just reaching over a crowd to get your next glass of wine. Because that's what Chandon was at the bar. They had like their own wine club section where you could like sit down and chill. But for the most part, it was just belly up to the bar. And now it's a much more curated, dialed-in experience where it's like seated, you kick back, you relax, you can order food from their kitchen, which is actually very, very good. They do a great job. But they provide more of an experience, right? But you do have to pay for that, right? Now, whether or not it has a huge impact on their bottom line, whether it was during the big days where they would see hundreds or thousands of people, or more like today where it's less people, but, you know, more wine buying, theoretically, you know, they're doing what's right for their business and they've made these adjustments. Boisset has decided like, hey, this is what we're going to bring back because theoretically, we're going to bring more people through the door. We're going to see more volume. We're hopefully going to sell more wine, and that's going to make up the difference for not charging this tasting fee. And then you have the small brands. It's like, hey, we can't just pour this wine willy-nilly. We only make so much of it. We're going to sell out of this stuff. We're going to have to charge you something, but if you're buying wine, we'll take care of you. You scratch our back, we scratch yours. Boom, bang, bippity-boppity-boo. Everyone's happy. I don't know what that was. I think I just blacked out for a minute. Anyway, this is like these last articles have seen kind of like the trends of how expensive it is getting. Some of the folks that just aren't waiving these tasting fees, while others are like, hey, we're going to start waiving some of these entirely. And then you have some of us, a lot of us, and I think the overwhelming majority of wineries and businesses in the middle, where we're going to kind of make a game time decision, right? Depending on what you're buying, whether you're joining our wine club, whatever the case is, yes, there's some flexibility here to help you guys out and try to, you know, give you a good deal while not selling the family farm. You know what I mean? And there are other businesses that are big enough that can say, hey, yes, we can offer this because the loss that we're taking on tastings now will hopefully be made up in the volume that we're going to sell, or it's a rounding error to begin with. And yeah, that might sting a little bit from a revenue perspective initially, but long term, what's the benefit? To put a bow on this, that's really the crux of the issue when it comes to the wine industry. We all know that this is a long game. And I think more recently, now, we've had a lot of tumultuous years between a fire out here, a supply chain crisis, which increased the cost of doing business by like 40, 60% in some cases. There's been a lot of reasons for us to raise prices, charge people more, as a result, charge people more for tastings and experiences and the bottles of wine that we're selling. Minus a world war that may or may not be starting. We'll see how this all shakes out, right? You know, if things start to stabilize, are you going to see some of this like recede a little bit, right? Are you going to see the tide kind of roll back out, especially with, you know, oversupply and under demand? Are you going to see the tide come back out and things be a little bit more competitive? Are you going to see brands that, you know, are on some hard times, are you going to get some great deals? Yeah, absolutely. Are there going to be people that kind of hold the line and say, you know what? We're doing okay. This is kind of where we're at, to be honest. It's like, we're doing okay, all things considered. We do need to sell some more wine, but we're weathering the storm. And if we can get through this, we're not going to need to take a price increase. We're not going to need to try and do deep discounts and hurt our brand in the long term. We can stick to our guns and try to evolve and roll with the punches and the times and get better at what we do. In fact, that's the mentality that Brittany and I have taken, is that we, over the last, you know, gear, we've started really, really checking under the hood. We've taken apart this engine that runs MTGA and Blair Payton and said, how can we fine-tune this thing? How can we squeeze out a little bit more horsepower out of this thing. We're diving into this thing like an F1 engine. I have no idea what that sport's about, except that they drive fast and those cars are really expensive. And apparently all of my friends are into F1 now, and I need to watch Drive to Survive or whatever it is on Netflix. But you get the analogy that this is where, you know, the businesses that are doing all right or even doing really well and kind of breaking the trend, right, and seeing growth in tumultuous times. You know, that's where, you know, you can do some of this fine tuning and just get better at what you do. To go back to a statement that I made earlier in the show, if you're looking at that SVB report, that Silicon Valley Bank report, and it's enlightening to you, and you're like, oh my God, this is what's happening. You're so far behind. I don't know what to do, right? You're just not paying attention, right? You have to have your ear to the ground, you know, in this industry. You need some of the anecdotal evidence. You need to talk to your peers. You need to get to know people. You need to understand where they're at. We need to understand where you guys are at, the consumers. What do you like? What you don't like? Not just in terms of the wines you're drinking, but the experiences you're being offered. What we're charging you for said experiences. Is it worth it to you? Does our wine club system make sense? Are you the wines that you're receiving, do you actually enjoy them? Do you want it to be more customizable? Do you need it to, like, what do you need? And this industry, you know, there's a lot of people that kind of work in their silo and in an echo chamber, and they just march forward with kind of reckless abandon. And that's when you start seeing, you know, places go under. A lot of big names that we've seen in the news over the last year, closing up tasting rooms, going bankrupt, rolling up brands and saying, yeah, we're backing off all of this. I think it's a good thing. It's a correction. It sucks. There are a lot of people that are getting laid off. There's a lot of hard times and tough times. I don't want to wish that upon any individual who's trying to make a living in this industry because it's tough to do. But when you see something get so overinflated and so overly complicated, you need to hit the reset button at some point. And I think, to Rob McMillan's point in this direct-to-consumer report, I think that there's a good light at the end of the tunnel. It's not a train coming our way. It is, in fact, daylight. Whether or not we actually get out of this tunnel in the next 6 months, the next year, 18 months, whatever, yet to be seen. As I mentioned, I'm consistently, you know, cautiously optimistic. You know, again, anecdotally, we've seen, you know, a lot of people booking tastings and coming out to the winery this fall, already between August, September, October. It's gearing up to be one of the busier falls that we've had in recent history, which is great to see. We've done a lot of work on the road, you know, over the last spring and into this summer months to try and drum up business and kind of keep things moving. There's a lot of good stuff happening. It's going to take some patience for it to bounce back. And I think that as long as we as wineries continue to meet you guys, the beautiful people that support us in this crazy endeavor to make this juice into this beautiful beverage that we call wine, as long as we continue to try to be more transparent, to meet you where you are, not just halfway, but where you are, I think we'll be all right. There are going to be a lot of businesses that don't do that. And they're going to be not so well off as a result. There's going to be some of us that I think are really trying hard to make that happen. And it's going to allow us to do some very good things in the future. All right. Thank you all for tuning in. Appreciate you all. This has been the Wind Up Podcast. Please be sure to like, subscribe to the show, follow it wherever you're following your podcasts. Head to our social networks at MTGA Wines. I've been super lazy when it comes to posting, and I apologize. We got more updates coming for you. Honestly, there has been a lot going on. We've done some cellar work, some blending, which has been a lot of fun. I've been working on our front yard. I've completely redone our front yard over the last month. Been very exciting, a lot of fun. This is that time of year where I actually have time to work on the honey-do list. So the wine stuff slows down ever so slightly, like basically now and then never again for the rest of the year. So there will be more content coming, I promise. So follow us on those social networks, YouTube, Instagram, the social network formerly known as Twitter, and the Book of Face if you want to see our more regular updates. Be sure to head to our websites, mtgawines.com, blairpaytonwines.com. Check out our mailing list. Sign up for it. Check out some of the wines that we have available, all that good stuff. Be sure to be 21 years of age or older. Disclaimer, 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 just in case. Love you guys. Thank you so much for the amazing support, for tuning in, and we will catch you next week on the Wind Up Podcast. Cheers.